I built a little studio in my garage, and then later things got to going pretty good. We made a few dollars, and we bought more equipment, and I leased a building down not far from my house. And as a matter of fact, it's across the street from where Ray Charles' complex is now. Oh, yeah. But in those days, there was nothing like that around there. And, mm-hmm. and we put the recording studio in there, and we did all the Dig records in there. Mm-hmm. You know, local Dark things. Nights, yeah. Julie Stevens' Blue Mood was a big hit for us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You never heard it? No. Little Julian Herrera, because we had such a tremendous Mexican-American following. Little Julian Herrera was a Mexican kid, you know, in those days. We were very busy then. We were, you know, playing every night. Doing a television show once a week, doing a radio show every day. You know, we had to tape them and everything, and trying to produce some records on Capitol.
And so he's talking about the Dig Records and then getting started with Capitol. We're going to play one more side job that Johnny did. This dates back to the Peacock era, 1953. He did some work with Little Richard, and they cut three or four sides. And we'll hear directly from my heart to you. And then, just at the top of the hour, we'll move into the Capitol era.
In the early 50s, we noticed something.
And now it's time for the Johnny Otis Show. Johnny Otis.
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 Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis.
Hi, everyone. This is Johnny Otis, and that means it's time to rock. Get way back in the alley with the blues.
broadcasting from Fiddle College. This is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Now we're still rolling along with Brother from Another Planet, the Johnny Otis story. I'm Art Crimes, and my pal,
John Goldfarb.
We'll be here till 10. We're at that stage now where Johnny's moved over to Capitol Records, a big label, and he's doing some what can only be called as rock and roll. And he may have some regrets about it later on, but that's what's selling right now, as he mentioned in the discussion about the radio, that the kids just love this rock and roll stuff.
And here he is, the king of rock and roll, Johnny Otis. Well, come on, cats, let's rock this joint tonight. Come on, cats, let's rock this joint tonight. Shake it, Lucy, baby, everything is gonna be alright. We'll be rocking and rolling, jumping till the broad daylight. Yeah, we'll be rocking and rolling, jumping till the broad daylight. Come on and shake it, pretty baby, everything is gonna be alright. Well, the band was rocking, we were having a ball. Lucy jumped up and shook the plaster off the wall. Oh, yeah. Shake it, Lucy, baby, everything is gonna be all right. Oh, yeah. Her thoughts are juicy when she kisses me goodnight. Yeah, I love sweet Lucy, and her kisses are so juicy when she kisses me goodnight. I'll never leave her, I never will deceive her, and we'll never fuss and fight. Well, my sweet Lucy, she's my heart desire. Well, my Lucy, baby, she sets my soul on fire. Shake it, Lucy, baby, everything is gonna be in the middle of a rock and roll beat. Lucy started shaking in the middle of the street. She shot up in the air like a thunder jet. I guess she's still flying, we ain't found her yet. Fly on, Lucy, baby. Fail on and on. Shake it, Lucy, baby. Everything is gonna be alright. Hey! We'll be right back.
In the early 50s, we noticed something. We noticed the white audience being attracted to a certain kind of rhythm and blues. And as we watched it and attempted to analyze what was going on, we saw that there were that the white audience, or the pop, well, it wasn't a pop audience yet, but the white audience, the young white audience, did not understand or react to the blues element in rhythm and blues. They reacted to the rhythm element in rhythm and blues. And we found that we could contrive and almost hoke up certain, you know, and the saxophone's going, ah! And laying down on his back, you know, someone referred to that as a blues obscenity recently, and I guess he's right. Mm-hmm. And you know, we just tried to make money, and you know, that the minute you start that crap, I'm very ashamed of that period in my life. I'll tell you, I'm laughing, but I'm not tickled. I'm ashamed of that. I was as guilty as many of the rest of us. But we've been broke so goddamn long with all that programmed rock and roll cliches. And that, of course, was... and the bandstand was on now, that Dick Clark thing, and the kids would scream. So let's get that on record. It'd probably be a big hit. Well, it was not a big hit in America, but it was in England.
It's funny, isn't it?
Isn't that strange? Mm-hmm. And then, as a result of that success in England, we were booked, you know. We were booked and we were coming over, but the Ministry of Labor and the musicians' unions, both American and British, were not, you know, they had no accommodation. Mm-hmm. But since then, the Beatles changed all that. Anyhow, the tour didn't come off, but while it was imminent, Hal Zeiger, who was my partner at the time, goes to England and sets it up. While he comes back, he says, listen, I saw something phenomenal while I was there. I went to the music halls, the concert halls. There were no places that I saw any kids dancing. They were all seated, but they're doing a thing that the black bands, you guys used to do in the old days, you know, that, and they call it hand jive. I said, that thing that we used to do in the Rolling. He said, yeah. He said, write a song called hand jive. I bet it'll be a big hit in England. So we did, and it was a big hit over here.
That's right.
Bo Diddley and Hambone. Do you remember Hambone?
Mm-hmm.
Hambone, mm-hmm. Where have you been? Because that's where Bo Diddley got it, too.
That's right. Well, what was that?
And another man whom you'll never... Well, that was Hambone, was way back before Bo Diddley. And there's another place where that rhythm came from a man named Count Otis Matthews, the first band I ever played with, who actually had a can... Two cans with rice in them. He made them. And he wouldn't give them to the cats in the band. He'd give them to chicks. And they'd shake. And he told me to play Shaving a Haircut 6 bits on the drums.
That's right.
See? And they go ching, ching, ching. And he'd sing, Mama bought a chicken, thought it was a duck, stuck him on the table with his legs stuck up. It was very much like Bo Diddley. And this is in the
30s. Really?
Yeah. So there's no doubt that it's a Bo, it was known as a Bo Diddley rhythm,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't invent it.
I know a cat named Way Out Willie. He got a cool little chick named Rockin' Billy. He can walk and stroll in Susie Q and do that crazy hand jive too. Sister Flo, Grandma gave baby sister time, said do that hand jive one more time. Doctor and a lawyer and an Indian chief, now they all dig that crazy beat. Way Out Willie gave them all a treat when he did that hand jive with his feet. Willie on TV. Hand jive.
And there we have Hand Jive. Certainly, for anybody who has a casual understanding of Johnny Otis, that was the track they would probably know about. Been covered by so many acts to this very day. But pretty basic, as Johnny points out. It's just that rhythm. And a lot of the stuff that Johnny did in this era, he wasn't particularly crazy about, but it was kind of, you know, that's what was selling. And so occasionally he would make reference to the fact that he was not really in love with this rock and roll thing, but that's what he had to do at that time.
He certainly was a businessman, in that right and in other rights too. As he was moving along through his musical career, he was finding other entrepreneurial types of actions, and he actually alluded to it in one of the clips you played earlier in the show, where he started a chicken business with his bass player, Mario Delagarde. They called their business Progressive Poultry Company. This is back in the mid-40s. And it was a business. Johnny did most of the prep work. Johnny he devoted 2 acres of his property to the chickens. He built chicken coops. He fed, watered, and dressed the dead chickens as fryers and broilers. And then they bought an ice cream truck, and Delagarde would drive around L.A., the L.A. neighborhood, selling the chickens and eggs from that ice cream truck. And that was their business. Well, it was great business. Unfortunately, it did hamper Johnny's musical career in a way. In 1949, he was building a chicken coop for the business, and he was using a power saw. His hand slipped, and it ended up cutting the second and third fingers of his right hand down to the bone, actually severing the tendons in the fingers. And so he bandaged it up as best he could, went to a doctor, and at first they thought they were going to have to amputate the fingers, but the doctor found a way around that. But while doing that, he accidentally, in the operation, left Johnny's right hand in a flexed position, making it impossible for him to hold drumsticks properly, especially for swing music. He was able to still play basic R&B rhythms. But being Johnny Otis, he stuck through it, obviously,
And that was one of the things that led to him playing the vibes, something that wasn't hampered by his hand injury, whereas his drumming, he couldn't really do the style of drumming he had done as in the big bands early on, but he played vibes throughout the rest of his career, as well as a bit of piano, although I always point out that he wasn't necessarily a great pianist, but he could certainly pound things out. This is a period of time when Johnny kind of recedes a bit from the story, you know, after the Capitol sides run out, he's kind of a little bit out of style for a while. You know, certainly as soon as the British invasion happens and, rock as we know it starts to become more of a prominent thing, Johnny moved on to other activities, and there were many of them.
He actually wrote a column for a major black newspaper in L.A. called The Sentinel, wrote opinion pieces about all the injustices he was seeing done to the blacks down there in Los Angeles, around the country. And we're getting pretty close to the passing of the civil rights legislation in Congress from 1964-65. In California, Johnny started getting politically active. He actually ran for state assembly in the early 60s and then in the later 60s, twice, ran for state assembly, was able to campaign as Johnny Otis, but unfortunately the state would not let him use Johnny Otis as his name on the ballot, so he had to use his given birth name, John Billy Otis, which probably lost him both races. And then, in addition to running from several, by the way, he's also elected to the Central Committee of the Democratic Party in Los Angeles County during that time. He also befriended, well, I shouldn't say befriended, because he already knew him before, Melvin Dimely, who was the only, the first black American to hold an executive office in California. He ended up being, for Jerry Brown's first term as governor, he was elected the lieutenant governor in 1978. And Johnny had known Mervyn Dimely since 1949, and then got involved with helping him run for state assembly in 1962, served as his deputy chief of staff when Dimely won his state assembly seat in 62. And then Dimely ran for Congress in 1980, and won a seat in Congress there in 1980. And during that time, Johnny supervised the constituent services in Dimely's home office in Hawthorne, California. So that was definitely different for him. He was still doing a little bit of music work. He was doing some production work for a lot of gospel groups. As a matter of fact, one was called the California Gospel Caravan, which featured a young Billy Preston. And but he definitely had moved away from the entertainment life. I think he had dropped his TV show by now too, at least in the early 60s.
And when Johnny returned to the music business in the late 60s, things had changed pretty radically about the type of music that was popular. Johnny had at this point enlisted his son, Shuggy. It's not his son's real name was John, but Shuggy was from Sugar, kind of a nickname, and Shuggy Otis, he kept the name. Shuggy's still around, and we had sent out some inquiries with Shuggy, and I did have a very brief email conversation with him about doing this special, and we couldn't quite get things together to talk to him, but he was glad we were doing it. And he wanted folks to know that he's going to have some reissues of his classic, three classic epic LPs. And so we're going to hear a little bit of the music that Shuggy was doing, and then Shuggy will bring us back to Johnny's story as we hear the tracks that they did together. But the next couple of tracks are ones that, in a lot of ways, they're really Shuggy's solo efforts, in that he was playing virtually every instrument on a couple of his records. This stuff really kind of was very underground for a long time, and then for the usual reasons, people started picking up on it. One of his tunes was covered very successful by the Brothers Johnson, and that probably is most people's awareness of Shuggy is the song that he wrote that they ended up doing. But we're going to hear something that shows a distinct flavor of a kind of the experimental soul music that Sly Stone was doing around the same time period. This is from Shuggy's third epic release, Inspiration Information, and the track, I'm hope I'm saying this right, Out of My Head. Here in KFJC, Shuggy Otis.
Out of my head. you. Red magic sat playing in tune. All through the morning rain, I guess the sun doesn't shine. Rainbows and waterfalls run through my mind. In the garden, I see was purple shower bells and tea.
Sugi Otis, that's Strawberry Letter 22 from his second LP, Freedom Fight. And very ambitious music. You can see that he little distortion there. This is more or less a home recording that he put together. But on other portions of his recordings, he's got world-class session guys like Wilton Felder and George Duke pitching in. So he was really breaking out of the world of the Johnny Otis shows that he was actually participating in, playing his father's music. But what he's doing on his own was very experimental, and I'm glad that people finally discovered it, even though it took 30 years or so.
Let's not forget that he was one of the guitarists who the Rolling Stones had considered for when Mick Taylor left the band as being
right.
a replacement.
And the people are still wondering whether it was a good decision or not to turn down the Stones. You know, it is a high risk occupation, I think. So maybe Sugar knew what I was doing when he turned that down. But it did indicate that at least he was seen as a real a great player. And frankly, you know, the music that he did play with his father was somewhat limited in that they were still really doing the rock and roll and the R&B style stuff, and Sugar didn't really get to stand out and do his own thing. So he had his own solo career to exploit that. And then he kind of went underground, and not much has been heard from him for a very long time, although he did tour with his father into the 90s. I think there's the recordings and the live show often feature Sugar. And then eventually... Sugar's own son, and they're carrying on. Mr. Goldfarb and myself actually saw the latest and perhaps the last version of the Johnny Otis Show. I don't know how often they're going to get together to do it, but led by Lucky,
the grandson of Sugar,
and
son of Sugar,
yes, yeah, son of Sugar, and grandson Johnny. Of Johnny, and amazingly enough, they had. Johnny's vibes out front, and Lucky's playing those vibes just like his grandfather did. So they're passing it on one more time. Fascinating to see the group. It was sort of a composite group of various alumni from the Johnny Otis bands of time past. And they did a few of the songs made popular by Johnny, but also a lot of covers of just their favorite soul and R&B tunes. And I was very impressed with Lucky. He played piano pretty well, and played the vibes. He only sang maybe a little bit. He didn't seem to have the confidence of his father as far as get out on stage and throwing it down. But nice to see that he learned a lot from his ancestors.
Lucy, yeah, probably should throw in here. It was a key point in Johnny Otis's life. Again, he'd been living since the early 40s in South Central L.A. and owned homes thereabouts in Watts. And in 1965, in August of 65 specifically, the Watts riots broke out and burned a lot of what Johnny Otis had grown to know and love down to the ground. He was very torn up about it, probably because it was one of the first times he remembered that he was actually white, even though he'd been living his life as a black man. He wrote a book that was published in 1968 called Listen to the Lambs, which was born out of a letter he'd written to a friend shortly after the riots. And then right after the riots, he started collecting testimony from eyewitnesses that he intended to be part of a book. Listen to the Lambs mixes his political ruminations and social ruminations of what's happened to the black community, or what hasn't happened to the black community at that time period, with the civil rights movement bringing about the Civil Rights Act. And he also mixes in memories of his childhood and more memories of South Central L.A. as it was in the 40s and 50s. Fascinating read. Short read, but fascinating read. So, back to the music.
Yeah, we'll have a next segment from KPPC Radio in November 1970. And, you know, towards the end of the 60s, some interesting things started happening with Frank Zappa getting somewhat involved with some of Johnny's projects, and vice versa. Sugar ended up playing on Frank Zappa's Hot Rats, and Sugarcane Harris, a character that was part of Johnny's shows and recordings from time to time, also played with Zappa during that same period of time. In fact, they did the same Little Richard song that we heard a little while ago, an update of that with Sugarcane singing. And they also shared a lot of the session players. It was really interesting to me as a Zappa fan to see how many connections there were. Frank even, you know, had done his hair, his facial hair, a little bit like Johnny, and I think that might have been a sort of a tribute in his own way. If you look on the back of the Reuben and the Jets Mothers of Invention record, there's a picture of Frank, and the picture we're looking at of Johnny Otis right now is very much in the same style. The greasy hair and the little thing on the chin. Anyway, Johnny did say that actually Frank had occasionally come to see him when Frank was quite a bit younger and not really much of a personality as far as any notoriety that he would obtain later as being a sort of a strange rock artist. But and then eventually it kind of turned around where Johnny went looking to Frank sometimes for some advice on things. We're going to hear a little segment that they did with Johnny and Shuggie and Frank on the radio. Frank and Shuggie both have guitars, and they do a little improv, and Johnny introduces them both. So this segment runs about 10 or 11 minutes, once again from November 1970, KPPC, I think that's Pasadena College. So this is a college station, just like the one you're listening to right now here on KFJC.
Oh, let's see. Let me come over and get to a mic so I can. That's it here for me.
Sure.
Okay. Here we are back at Control Center. We have our guest tonight has been Frank Zappa, and we've kidded a lot, but I'd like to thank Frank sincerely for being with us. It's really been wonderful. We had a lot of calls. I know you're enjoying it out there too. I can hear you breathing out there. Shuggie. Son Shuggie and Frank Zappa now are going to team up on a little duet with two acoustical guitars. This should be wonderful. And they'll play...
Peace
it better be. And they'll play the show right on out. We got about 10 or 11 minutes. Play as long as you want to, right?
Right.
You know. But, hey, Frank, give us a... Why don't you and Shuggie... The three of us can do it. Shall we do our impression of the... what are those cats you've got on record that sing so well, a cappella?
What, the Persuasions?
The Persuasions. Why don't we do the three of us, three-fifths of the Persuasions plastered?
Well, I don't know.
Say, listen, man, they tell me the other day we can get plastered.
No. It can't be the same person, no.
Incidentally, how's Cynthia?
She's fine.
Lixie?
She's on her way over to your house, Johnny. She's got her eye on you, Johnny. Ladies and gentlemen, how would you feel about Johnny Otis himself being plaster casted?
There's not a point of how they feel about it. It's just me. I can't talk.
You gotta send in your cards and letters if you want Johnny to actually submit to a plaster casting.
You got it right. Submit is right. Not agree, but submit. Well,
you'll have a good time, Johnny.
Just here we go, folks. One, two, and a half, and three, and KPPC.
In Pasadena.
Shuggie, give us a little, sing something, man. Get in there so we can all get scale. What are we going to call this song you guys are going
to? I think Bill wants to do it. Here you go.
Okay, let's dream up a thing. It's called Frankie and Shuggie.
You want to start it?
Yeah, do it in D.
Okay.
989, KFJC, Brother from Another Planet, the special. I'm John Goldfarb.
Art Crimes here.
And we've just been listening to some of the stuff recorded late in the 60s by Johnny Otis. Surely sounding a little bit different from what we've heard up to this point. We just heard from the epic release Cold Shot, instrumental written by Johnny and Shuggie, if I remember correctly, and featuring the violin work of Sugarcane Harris, Don Sugarcane Harris.
I think this was actually on another label. This is before Epic.
Was that a Kent?
I think it was Kent.
But
Epic offered Johnny and also Shuggie on his own contracts coming out of this project. And this is around the same time also that they did the Monterey show. I'm not sure if Monterey was the first release
later
on Epic or if there was one before that.
Yeah.
That other one, Cutting Up may have been preceded.
Oh yeah, definitely did. I think it was recorded in 68 and released very early on in 69. And we also heard before that the jam at KPPC in Pasadena, California between Shuggie Otis and Frank Zappa from November 2nd, 1970. We're actually getting into the 70s here, and this is a period of time, again, when Johnny kind of laid back on the music a little bit, but he was heavily involved in going back to his radio broadcasting and television. That was from one of his radio shows that we heard that before they jammed a little bit of Johnny Otis's yapping. He started doing the radio show in 1975 once again with KPPC, and then later the Pacifica station down in
KPFK,
right,
sister station to Berkeley's KPFA,
correct. And before he started doing the radio broadcasting, he was actually once again doing television broadcasting. What he did was he